Hi, my name is Bram. I'm an information architect. Two colleagues of mine also joined me. This is Simon and Thomas. Simon is a web designer, Thomas is a front-end developer. And we all work in a digital agency, Netlash BC. You may remember us from such clients as Telenet, NMBS Europe, Jetair Fly, AB Concerts. Recently we also launched the new Humo website. Of course, we also have a lot of less famous clients. This presentation will be available online, and later we will also write a following-up blog post about it. You will be able to find it on netlash.com/blog. Today we're going to talk about three parts. Each of us will talk from his own experience, from what he's specialized in. I'm going to tell you a little bit about why you should use responsive design, and also what it is, what the advantages are. My colleague Simon is going to talk about design responsive design, so how to do that. And finally, Thomas is going to dive into the more technical details, some solutions, some tips and tricks. So why responsive design? My part is in four points. First, I'm going to explain you how not to approach mobile web. Then why responsive design is key, why that is a good solution. Why you should think mobile first. And finally, I'm going to explain you why it all starts with information architecture. I'm not going to show you any stats or numbers. You're all sitting here, so you know mobile is very important. So I'm not going to go into that. So how not to approach mobile web. I'm going to stand a bit closer to my laptop because this remote doesn't work so good. So let's imagine we have a mobile operator in 2006. And the CEO of that company says, like, oh, we need a mobile website, because in 2006 this was booming, and especially for a mobile operator, something very important to have. So what did you get? Got then the typically mobile websites that start with m dot or mobile dot, and very typically they all had a link go to the full website, which is a bit strange, because why don't you have immediately all the information on the mobile one? So in my opinion, there are some issues with that, a separate mobile website. What do you do with tablet PCs? Should they go to the full website or to the mobile website? There's not really something for them that is optimized. What about new devices in the future that will have unknown display sizes? There's nothing for them. So I'm going to ask you a question now. Raise your hand if you never used your smartphone laying in bed. I see a few hands, but most of people did. It's very normal. Because don't make the assumption that mobile users are users on the road. In a lot of cases, you're just sitting on the couch and you want to find some information and you use your smartphone. And statistics show that this is happening more and more. So you probably need all your content of your full desktop website also on your mobile website. I tried something. I posed myself the question, how should I configure my phone to use mobile internet? So thinking again about those mobile operators, I surfed to all their websites and I tried to find that information. So how to configure my mobile phone, something very important, especially for a mobile operator to provide that information. Now, on the mobile website of Proximus, I couldn't find it. They had all kinds of news and games and advertisements, but no information. The same goes for Mobistar. Same goes for Base. So all the big Belgian mobile operators, nothing on that. They have something on budget games, but I'm not interested in that when I surf to a mobile website. Even Mobile Vikings, a mobile operator that is focusing very hard on mobile data traffic, they only had some basic information, but nothing about how I could configure my mobile phone, which is very sad. So this to show you that you need all your information in a lot of cases also on your mobile website, which means if you're going to build a separate mobile website, your client has to manage all the content twice in two different systems. Another issue, users share links. And different users use different devices. So when a user on a smartphone shares a link and somebody on a desktop computer opens that, will he open it then in the mobile website or in the full website? So you have to build in some kind of detection system. Most of the times it doesn't work so good. So you get redirected to the homepage and you have to search all the information again, which is really a shame because a lot of users just close the website and don't continue. So to conclude about separate mobile websites, they're only optimized for small screens. You need to provide all content, which means all content has to be managed twice. There are some issues when sharing content. So rounding that all up, it's a pretty expensive solution with a quite unsatisfying result. So next, we skip in time. Let's imagine a newspaper company in 2010. What was very big in 2010? Apps. Everybody wanted an app. Also, all the big newspapers in Belgium, for example, they all have news apps. I took just one example. There are a lot of them. What I say is, this is a big fail. And I'm going to explain you why. So some issues with native apps. Actually, you have the same issues as with separate mobile websites. What about tablet PCs? Of course, you can also build an app optimized for tablets, but this will cost a lot more time and money. Again, mobile users are not users on the road, so you need to provide all your information, which means again that all the information, all the content has to be managed twice. What are you going to do about platforms? There are now three big platforms. You have iOS, Android, and Windows Phone. Are you going to build an application for all those platforms? Of course you can, but this will cost a lot of time. And with each update, you need the same amount of time. It also might take some time to get approval. In the App Store, for example, of Apple, you need to wait if you build an update until Apple says, okay, the update can be launched, will be available for everybody. Another issue, store owners, not all of them, but some do, take a cut in-app purchases. So if you want to offer licenses to your clients, you have to consider that a certain amount of the money you get will go to the store owner. And then a very important thing, what about search engines? If I'm searching something on Google on my smartphone, I'm not going to end up in an app. So I want to find that information and I cannot find it on Google when it's in an app. So you actually lose a lot of clients if your information is only available on an app for mobile users. And then last, something as an information architect that I also find very important, there are some usability issues. In an app, when you want to link to a website, a new app opens. We saw this morning that you can, for example, in Windows Phone, you can, with the back button, you can go back to previous apps, but not on all platforms it works so good. So if you click on a link and you open the browser, you cannot use the back button to go back to the page you were in the app. Also, native browser functions like bookmarking, in apps you don't have that. If you're lucky, the app builder provided them, but that's not always the case. there's some issues with selectable text. It's not always possible in apps, so you cannot always copy-paste some information you like to use somewhere else. And apps often have their own interface language. Although this morning we saw, I think her name was Corina, she explained a lot about how you should use the Mater language to make sure that apps have a consistent interface. Not everybody does this. So in a lot of cases, users really have to try to figure out how does this app work and what happens if I click this button. And this reminded me to something. I don't know if you have the same feeling, but so issues with links to other websites, no native browser functions like bookmarking, non-selectable texts, and each interface is a bit different. I'm going to give you a hint. It reminded me a lot about full-flash websites. They had the same issues. And all I want to say is, please, let's not go there again. It has been solved. Full-flash websites are dying. Let's not create the same issues in another platform. Of course, I want to say native apps can also be a good solution. I'm putting everything a bit extreme. But if you need hardware functions that are not yet supported in browsers, then of course a native app can be a very good solution to a problem. I'm thinking about if you need a compass, a camera, a gyroscope, GPU power, so for games or navigation apps, a native app is still the best solution. So native apps, you have to consider if you're going that way that you have to provide support for different platforms. There might be a cut on in-app purchases. Content has to be managed twice, and it won't be indexed by search engines. There's a risk on usability issues. So, if you want to build an app for a content-driven website, then a native app might not be the best solution. That sums it up again. So an answer to that is responsive websites. Responsive is key. What is a responsive web design? You have one website, so the content is managed on one place, in one CMS mostly. So there's no issues with sharing content or with indexing by search engines. There's mostly one design, but a layout that adapts to different kinds of screen sizes. So you always see something that is optimized for the device you use. This is an example of a website we recently launched. It's handelsbeurs.be. And you can see that in different screen sizes, the design is exactly the same. You recognize it very good, but it's completely adapted to the screen size that is available. So when you would search for this concert, for example, in Google, no matter what device you find or you search the answer with, the layout will be presented in a very optimized way. So how do you start with that, with responsive design? Our process in NetLash BeSeen is we start with online strategy. So we make sure that we understand the client very good, that we know his targets, that we know the target group very good. And out of that, that information goes to the information architect. So what I do then is I create a prototype in which the designers and the developers can see which information should go on which place in the website. So then the designer does its thing. He makes a design. The front-end developer or front-end designer, he creates the HTML and CSS code. And finally, the developers do their magic, so they make the website really work. In all of those steps, I'm going to yeah, and all of those steps, it's very important to think mobile first. First, going to say what this does not mean, because a lot of people make wrong assumptions about it. Mobile first does not mean that you should only focus on mobile from now on. It also does not mean that mobile is more important than desktop. So let's get this straight. So if you create a website, you have two options. You can think mobile first, and you can think desktop first. Why is mobile first better? Because a mobile website is harder to use for visitors. It has a smaller screen. It has touch instead of a keyboard and a mousepad. The internet connection is mostly slower. So contrary to desktop websites, you have to do a lot more effort to make it very easy to use, to make it very usable. Users also typically have less patience, so because of the fact it's harder to use, also because they might be on the move, not all the time, we saw that before, and if they're on the move, mostly they need the information right now. If people are surfing on a computer and they're looking for information, sometimes that information is to use later on. If you surf on a smartphone, in a lot of cases you need that information now because you want to use it immediately. So it needs to work very easy and very, very quick. If you think mobile first, so if you make sure that the mobile site works very good, it has also another advantage because it forces you to focus. On mobile devices, there's no space for complexity. There's no space for extras, so you really have to focus on the core features and make them very simply and very usable. So a nice quote I thought is, it's easier to make a simple thing more complex than to make a complex thing more simple. So if you start with a simple thing, then you can add some extras if there's space for it, but the other way around it's very difficult. So start with a simple core that works very good. And something else, if you can support the mobile web, you can support anything. So if your website works good on mobile devices, then you can expand it a little bit, and it's easier to make it also work good on larger screens. So again, our process. I'm going to give you some hints about information architecture, what I do to take the mobile thing into account. My colleague Simon is going to talk more about the design, and finally you will get some front-end tips from Thomas. So IA for mobile, I said here, actually it counts as much for desktop, because if you take all those things into account, you might also create a very good desktop size website. First of all, know the online strategy. It's maybe a bit silly to say, but it's very important. You should know three basics. You should know your target audience very good. You should know the goal of the client and the USP of the client. And with those three ingredients, you can really try to create a conversion strategy that is really very focused and very targeted to make sure those targets are reached. Then if you think about the structure of your website and the functionalities it should provide, then there are some things to take into account. I think the KISS principle, keep it simple and straightforward, is very important. For example, in the main menu of your website, focus on the top tasks that your visitors have. In a lot of cases, this is the same as the key services that the company provides. So what do I mean with that? In a website, sometimes you see that the company sells products and solutions, but this is a bit silly because every company has that. So don't put that in your main menu. Make it concrete. Really say which products and which solutions. So it's easier for visitors to find what they're looking for. In all pages, use short and simple copy. Copy is the text, the content. and throw away anything that is that isn't needed. It's not forbidden to have white space, so if you have a very simple page with not a lot of information, that is very easy for visitors to choose what to go next to, then this is okay. You don't have to fill it up with other things to get rid of the white space. Just leave it very simple. It will work a lot better. And then if you build a page or if you design a page, make sure that the conclusion is at the top and then let the details follow. So if a user lands on a page, that he can immediately see, ah, this page is about that. If I want to know more, then I will scroll. So don't do it the other way around. The conclusion should not be at the end. Then another principle, don't make me think. There's also a book about that. You will find it if you search for it. It's very famous. And this means that at any point, it should be clear for a visitor how to get closer to the answer he wants. So this also means that an extra click is no problem. It's a lot better than trying to create a very complex navigation where you have drop-down menus that again drop out something else. So an extra click is okay. Make your pages very easy and simple. So it's very clear, like, if I'm looking for an answer, if I click on that, I get a bit closer. For that, we use actually two types of pages. So creating a website is not so difficult. You have a choice page and an action page. I will show an example of the first one. So the page where you have to make a choice means a page where there's not a final answer for the user, but where he needs to choose, like, which link should I click or which button should I click to get closer to my answer. So home page is also a choice page, because on a home page you have to try to see where should I click to get to the answer I want to find. An action page, there you have found your answer, and that page should try to persuade the user to make an action, to subscribe to a newsletter, to buy a product, to make contact with a company. So a very good example of such a choice page is this website. This was recently launched. We didn't make it, but I found it a very good example, so I wanted to show it. It's JobHat. It's also a responsive website. And you can see here when you're on the page solliciteren, that it's very easy. They divided it up in boxes where you have to click to get closer to the topic you're searching for. So the conclusion so far for this part is for content-driven websites, responsive web design is really the future. If you're going to build a responsive website, then think mobile first in all phases and use the KISS principle. So keep it simple and straightforward. Focus on core tasks. And this starts with information architecture. Simon?
Okay, thank you, Bram. So my name is Simon, Simon in Dutch, if you like. So I am a web designer at Netlife Bicine. So after Bram did his thing and made his structure in the information architecture phase, I start designing. I'm going to talk about some of the web design trends I'm seeing latestly. Where to start and how to start designing your responsive design. Whether to use a fluid grid and a fixed grid. And some other design decisions that are made beyond Photoshop. I'm going to start with the definition of responsive web design, cornered by Ethan Marcotte back in 2010 on his article on A List Apart. So he says, responsive web design consists of three components: a fluid grid, fluid media, and media queries. I'm going to come back on the components of fluid grid later on, and Thomas is going to talk about more fluid media and media queries. But first I want to show you some sites, some good examples of responsive websites. I invite you to visit them on your smartphone to see how they react on your phone in landscape mode and in portrait mode. If you have an iPad, you can use it right now. So the first one is informationarchitects.gp. As you can see, this is this website uses really basic design principles and digital typography. And the design is so good because how it works. It's interesting to see what design decisions they made when you narrow the viewports. The second site I'm showing you is simplebits.com. It is the web page of designer, speaker, and author Dan Sederholm. He has a really unique and simplistic, but also beautiful style and approach to web design. His design decisions are very subtle. For example, the permalink on the right side of the page on widescreen is on the right side, and when you narrow it down, it becomes underneath the metadata, stuff like that. And for web blogs and blogs website like this, it feels really natural to optimize your content for different screen sizes. It isn't that obvious for big content-heavy websites like, for example, the BostonGlobe.com, but they did it anyway. And for many people, this was the proof that responsive web design is indeed a solid solution. It adapts really nice to different viewports and devices. Personally, I have some thoughts about some of the details. For example, the search button on the search bar is not as big as the search bar itself, but the layout is really good and it serves its purpose. So if you want to look at other responsive websites and good examples of responsive websites, I suggest you visit mediaquery.es. And so when looking at these websites and some other websites, I try to make some conclusion about some web design trends I'm seeing. So the first thing that is really obvious that the focus really is now even more than ever on content and organization of content. So content comes first, and web design gets a supportive role. And of course, with the revolution of digital typography, we can really make good decisions about that. And we don't really need anymore the unnecessary visual design elements. For example, these big and bloated background images. You can just choose a few good fonts and your website already looks good. The reason I think for many of these simplistic approaches to web design is that because a lot of good web designers know, and they should know how to put together a web page using HTML and CSS, so they design directly in the browser. And the reason for that are pretty obvious, because if we web designers are artists, then the browser is our true canvas. Another reason is that a static image, like a JPEG you show to your client, doesn't feel like a real web page, because you can't select text. The text is rendered differently even. And designing directly in the browser makes you focus on content organization before design, and helps you ensure accessibility and appropriate hierarchy. Now, that's all very good, and that's cool. I've done it myself Just designing in the browser, writing CSS as you go. But at Netlash Be Seen, we still believe in designing in Photoshop because you can use it as a creative outlet. You don't have browser limitations, and you're going to try things. I think it's important you should still try things not possible only with CSS3. And regarding to responsive web design, it's useful to establish some sort of global visual design direction and use that as a starting point and something to fall back on, not only towards clients, but also at Netlash Be Seen. I don't always slice my own designs, and Thomas sometimes does that, so that's really handy for him to see what the design should look like and start with that. Now, before you start designing like crazy, I will want to stress out how important a good, solid information architecture document is for a hierarchy of information. Now, the first thing you should consider when you're designing for a responsive website is you don't have to design for pixels anymore. Forget about pixels. Think in proportions, ratios, percentages. To newsletter modules, stuff like that, and they will be smaller or wider depending on screen size you look at. So maybe the most important question to ask yourself is what width you should start designing for. I don't really have an answer for that, but in my experience, it's easiest and it works best to decide on a maximum width your website will be, because it can be smaller or wider than 1,000 pixels. And that width, of course, is dependent on the amount of content and on the amount of modules you're going to have in your website. And of course, old principles of web design still stand. No one wants to read a line of text that is too wide. So, a very useful tool in the toolbox of the web designer is a solid grid. Because a solid grid helps establish those proportions, those ratios I mentioned before. And I strongly suggest you forget about a 960 grid system or any other grid system you might use. Just make your own grid. You have the opportunity to really go nuts here. Why not make a website that is 2,400 pixels wide with gutters of 50 pixels? Why not? I want to share with you a very handy Photoshop extension, and it's the Module Grid extension. You can download it here on modulegrid.com. And it allows you to choose how much columns you want, how width the columns should be, and the gutter between those columns. Now, of course, this is all in pixels, but later on in the slice phase, these become percentages. And then it produces a layer that looks something like this. So I made this 1,000 pixels wide layout with 12 columns. Too bad we don't have responsive slideshows yet. Otherwise, I could show you a wider example. But say you have a website and you decided 1,000 pixels is actually the widest that it should be, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. And you have like these 9 modules on your homepage. Seeing this grid and seeing this layout, I don't think it's very difficult to imagine what it could look like if you narrow your viewport. And it could be something like this. So module 1 and 2 still have their same width, but they just become below each other. 3, 4, 5 and 6 still have the same width. Only 7, 8 and 9, you can see 8 and 9, of course, because your viewport is going to be longer. Get the same width as the module 1 and 2. It becomes even easier when you narrow the screen down to like smartphone and portrait mode. And of course the heights may vary now, but the proportions towards the grid still stay the same. So say you have made your design and the client is satisfied with it and you are satisfied with it. There are some design decisions you should make beyond Photoshop. And the first one is really important. It's choosing between a fluid grid and a fixed grid. Now, to show you this, the difference between them, I'm going to show you two sites that use them. So this is Cognition by the brilliant people of happycog.com, people like Jeffrey Zellman. And this is a fluid grid. So what this does, and you can see it better down here, what this does is that the content fluidly adapts to the viewport. Even the images resize, and at a certain point the layout changes, and that's what I mentioned before with the grid example. The other website is Fork CMS. That's the website for our own content management system, and this uses a fixed grid. So what this does is, you will see it immediately, instead of fluidly changing, it jumps to another fixed width. So now for some advantages and disadvantages. For the fluid grid, the page adapts to every possible resolution. You define your maximum width once. Below that, it just takes all. Your web page takes up all the available space that is needed. It is harder to achieve due to fluid media like images, video, iframes with Google Maps in it, or something like that. A fixed grid. What it does is it looks at the viewport width, and it defines a new width, a new fixed width to the web page. It is easier to achieve because at this point you can say an image should be this wide, it should be this wide. It doesn't have to be fluid. And one point, I think it's not optimized for maybe for future screen sizes. Say if we have this new device that has a screen resolution width of somewhere between a smartphone and portrait mode and a tablet and a smartphone in landscape mode and a tablet in portrait mode. So the Fork CMS size would still look like this. As to the HappyCog Cognition site, still uses up the available space that is needed. Now, I'm not going to tell you what grid you should decide on. I just think that we've been designing for fixed width for over a decade now. Why not embrace this new kind of layouting web pages? Another thing you might have noticed when you resize these websites is that some of the modules, like for example here, the logo will change. Oh dear. Okay, that's too bad. Okay, back online. No, we're not. This is really what I mentioned before with the modules that can be wider or narrower, and these are all design decisions that should be made again in close association with an information architect. So to conclude some of the best practices I said, define a maximum width, start with a solid grid to define your proportions, design for flexible modules, and use a fluid layout when possible. So now Thomas is going to tell you a bit more about the front-end part, the technical part.
Okay, thank you, Simon. So what am I going to talk about? So our process again. We had the information architecture, and Simon discussed the design. Now it's time to do some fun stuff on the front end with some media queries and other things. So what am I going to talk about? Media queries in specific, adaptive images, flexbox, and multi-column layouts. So first off, media queries. Who has used media queries in practice before? Raise your hand. Okay. Who has used these media queries for responsive websites in production? So has really launched a live website. Okay, so a few. That's good. So I first want to say media queries aren't new. They have been around for a long time, but they have been used differently than we use them now. We just use them to scope a certain type of media, for instance, print, where you define some print styles, and the browser will use them when the print is needed. Now, we just added some screen sizes. So we scope if the media is screen, and we just add some screen sizes to it. I just laid out some basics here, but you can always just set your own screen sizes as necessary. So the most common ones and known ones now are the smartphone's portrait, the smartphone's landscape mode, tablet's portrait, tablet's landscape, and other devices. And what you should keep into account here, using these max width media queries, is that you will get inheritance. So what do I mean by this? I will just show you a simple demo on it. So first off, I have two black boxes here. There are two divs. I will show you the HTML. Is this readable for everyone? I'll make this a little smaller. So I have these two boxes at the bottom. I just gave them a black color. What should happen when I make my screen more narrow? The first media query will be triggered, 767 pixels. The second box, too, will become green. So if I resize my browser, okay, that happens. Everything okay. Second media query, the one above, 479 pixels, the smaller one. When I trigger this one, what should happen, seeing here in the CSS, the first box should become red and the second one should become blue. But here in the browser, the second one stays green because the larger media query is below the smaller one. So you just have this typical CSS cascading effect, so really you have to take into account that this stuff happens. The other way around, if you don't want the inheritance, you just switch those, of course. You put the larger media queries at the top and the smaller ones at the bottom. So if I open this one, this is what's supposed to happen. So the first two boxes are black, the second one becomes green, and when it's getting more narrow, the second one becomes blue. So, of course, using these media queries, you will get some holes on different devices. You can't cover everything by just using these media queries. So you could use some more advanced ones and just scope some more screen sizes as well. Notice I used before only the max width media queries. In these more advanced ones, if you want to scope just some specific screen sizes, you can set a min width and a max width as well. So just scope everything in between and you won't have the inheritance. So the first one, max width 479 pixels, I could add a min width 0, but that would be kind of useless, so I just left it out. Then we have the smartphone's landscape again, the tablet's portrait mode, tablet's landscape and others, laptops and others. Then we have the really larger screens, and again, now we don't have the inheritance here because we just scope some specific parts. This is a useful way if you don't want the inheritance, but you should take into account that this requires more work because you have to test more media queries. And like I said before, you can just use some screen sizes as needed because lots of these are depending on the design. For a blog, for instance, the basic media queries probably will do. But for a website like the Boston Globe, you will have to scope a lot more screen sizes to cover everything every device that is possible. Fourth, are polyfills. The speaker before me, I just forgot his name, mentioned the polyfills as well. This is really important, especially when using the mobile-first approach. I'll explain that later. So what does this actually do? You just use a library to check if some features are natively supported by a browser. If not, you can provide a fallback or force the browser to support those features anyway using a backup library. So the most common library known is Modernizer. This is used to check if features are supported by the browser. If not, you can provide a fallback. That's why I want to mention this one, Respond.js. Using the mobile-first approach, it means that the first thing you slice, so the first thing that you convert from the design to the HTML and CSS, will be the mobile version of the website. Through the media queries, you want to scope all the larger screen sizes and set everything that is needed for those screen sizes in specific. Of course, there are some user... older browsers that don't support media queries yet, so you could use the Modernizer library to detect those browsers, and if media queries aren't supported, load this small JavaScript file which supports the media queries anyway. So especially for IS6 to 8, this can be really interesting. Last I want to mention here on media queries are frameworks. So if you don't have much experience with media queries in general, or grids, or designing, or whatever, there are lots of frameworks and good bases to start from. I just went on the web and Googled some. I found these, Less Framework, Golden Grid System, Skeleton, the CSS Grid, and the HTML5 Boilerplate. Especially this last one, if you don't have a lot of experience with HTML5 and CSS3 in specific, I could really recommend this one because this one isn't just about media queries, but about all the new stuff in general. Like Simon said before, it's useful as a base, but it's far more interesting, in my opinion, to start your own grid. This will only come with experience, so you just start playing around with these frameworks and you will notice what works best for you and adjust the framework to your needs itself. So we had the media queries. Second are adaptive images. Like Simon said, fruit media is a problem at the moment because text on a website easily adapts. That's not that big of an issue. But we have lots of screen sizes, and images are a real problem here. So just taking the screen size into account, you can easily solve this by using a max width in CSS. I set up a demo for this, and I close it. Okay, so I have this image. It's 750 pixels on 500. What happens if I resize my browser? The image just starts scaling with the screen size. Okay, that problem is solved. I'll maybe show you the code for this. Pretty easy, just add an image into the HTML and set a max width of 100%. So it scales to the screen size, problem solved. But then again, we have all these different devices. All these different devices have different screen sizes, and all these devices also have different download speeds. So you can't force a user to download a 500 kilobyte image on his smartphone when surfing the web on an edge connection. That would take a really, really long time, and the user wouldn't end up seeing the image anyway. So a possible solution is just do some image optimization. There are some tools for this, such as Image Optim and Smushit. What these actually do is just strip some excess data from the image and decrease the file size. So that's a good start to begin with. But the best solution here is to serve different images depending on the screen size. So you could write your own JavaScript, for instance, and detect the images and replace them as needed. But when a client manages his content through CMS, you can't know in advance which images he's going to upload and which images you will have to replace or won't replace. So that would be a mess. The best solution is actually an existing solution, is really replace the image when the page is loaded and check the current screen size. You can do this by using adaptive images. There's a website for it, adaptiveimages.com. When a user uploads an image into the CMS, different sizes of the image will be saved. I don't know if you can see them here at the bottom. These are some examples that will be saved. So when I narrow down my viewport and I reload the page, you will actually see that a different image is loaded with a much smaller file size, which is really handy for smartphones, etc. Third thing I wanted to talk about is Flexbox. This doesn't really have to do as much with responsive web design, but it can be useful to use. Unfortunately, I want to point out, this is still a working draft by the CSS working group, so browser support for this is really low at the moment. Still, in Chrome, they are rewriting the whole implementation, so if you want to play around with it, you best do it in Google Chrome. You can best use it at the moment for positioning elements, in my opinion. I have another demo to show you what I mean by this. So I just want to show this demo quickly on what Flexbox does. So I have a parent div here with three divs in it, 1, 2, and 3. What happens? I just set them to the new property display box. So this enables the flex property, and they divide the space available equally for those three divs. When I hover, I say to one of those divs, on hover, you have to be with 200 pixels, and the other ones will still divide the available space over those two. So if I hover over those, the first one becomes 200 pixels wide, and the other two still have equal widths, although I didn't define them. So they just flex on the moment I do that. A better example of some, or more useful example maybe, are input elements. Especially when you set a width to an input element of 100%, and you added some paddings to the input as well, that will probably cause a horizontal scroll bar to your page. What I did here is just set a flex property to the input field, so it takes up all the space it can. So if I resize my browser, it just adapts with it. So this could be really handy. Another useful example are navigation elements. So this is just a list, two list elements with hyperlinks in them. Again, here I set the display box property, and they divide the space over these two elements. I added here some more elements. I will show you the HTML for this. Okay, so this was the list with the two elements. I just have a list here. In the CSS, I defined a width of 800 pixels, and what this box flex property does is just take up all the available space and divide it equally. So I added some more elements on the next example. So we have some five list elements now. I set them to flex again. The list is still 800 pixels wide and everything is divided equally, as you can see here. When I just remove one, I don't have to do anything special, it just adapts. Another example is to take up the space available. Here I have this list again with these elements. So I have 5 elements. I didn't do anything with these elements, I just set the width of 800 pixels here again on the list itself. I disabled the flex on the list elements, and I just said to the last element that it has to flex. So the first 4 don't do anything, they just seem normal, they just have some padding as I defined in the CSS, but the last one takes up all the space that is available. So this kind of layout could be useful for page layouts instead of floating divs and setting the last one to a max width, because that isn't that easy. So display flexbox, this is actually the new syntax, you won't be able to use this yet. For now you should use display box with the necessary vendor prefixes if you want to play around with this. At the end of my presentation I also posted some links to the CSS specs for this, so you can find all the information that you need to start with this. Last, multi-columns. Good news, this is a candidate recommendation, so browser support is a lot better than for Flexbox here. You could have guessed, what does this do? It divides content into columns. So the biggest problem here now is that when you have layout with 2 columns of text, you would have to provide 2 editors or 2 text editors in the CMS for the client, and he would have to manage the text itself just to make it into 2 columns. Also, you would have to float those divs, and on different screen sizes and layouts that could cause some problems. Also, semantics here wouldn't be very good, because you have 2 divs with the same connecting text, and that doesn't really make sense. So this multi-column really is handy. A demo. So we have 3 columns here. When we check out the HTML, I just have a div class content. I have 3 paragraphs. I could just make it 1 paragraph, doesn't really matter. But I set a max width on the content, and I defined 3 columns. So what does it just do? It creates 3 columns for me, and it also wants to make these columns equal height. So if I just remove 1 paragraph, for instance, and we check this out, it will still be divided into 3 columns, but the height will be the same. Another one. For this one, I didn't set the column count, so I didn't really specify, hey, I want 3 columns. I just said, if you create columns, make them 500 pixels wide. So, this screen now is not just that wide enough, apparently. I'll change the CSS for this. So if I make those 400, okay. It is possible to create multiple columns that are 400 pixels wide, so it actually does this. But when I start narrowing my screen, it says, oh, 2 columns of 400 pixels aren't possible anymore, so I'll make it 1 column instead. Another example, when you start combining this with media queries, it gets really interesting. So again, you have the same div with the content, the 3 paragraphs here on top. I define the max width on the div class content of 800 pixels. I set the columns to 3, and I just started with defining some media queries with what should happen when the screen size gets more narrow. So if it gets below 767, excuse me, pixels, the columns will go from 3 to 2. So if I start resizing this, it jumps to 2 columns. For the more smaller one, I defined 1 column, because this would be the smartphone portrait mode. So 1 column would be enough to maintain the good readable text. So if you go 479 pixels, it becomes one column. So this can be really, really interesting for dividing text into columns, obviously. So you just specify a column count. There are some other properties available. Columns, you can use this one for shorthand notation. Then we have the column width, column count, the column gap. You can specify a column rule and a column span. There are actually lots more. I just summed up these here because I think these are the most interesting or most useful ones. Again, I posted a link at the end, a slide at the end with some links where you can find all the properties. These are those links. So these slides will be available online, so you will be able to check them out. So that was our presentation. Are there any questions about one of the three topics we discussed? Yes? I don't think. Well, I don't think that's what my colleague Bram discussed. I don't think it's such a good idea to replace the whole content or just leave parts out when designing a responsive website, because users on a smartphone, for instance, also want to see all that information. So you can't just serve different parts to different devices. And I think text or just some information won't do that much to the download speed. So I don't know if that's really an answer to your question. I know, but No, that's not. I really want to make sure that everyone understands. When designing a responsive website, you don't just go and hide things with CSS. You leave all the content, but you just reposition it so that the most important stuff is at the top and all the rest is at the bottom. So I know there are other websites like Wikipedia or Booking.com. They all have their different approaches to this responsive web design. But it also depends on what you want to do with that specific website. If you just want to serve information, or if it's a social networking platform such as Facebook, you will have to divide your content differently. So, any more questions? But how will your client know when he's editing his content in the CMS, which content will show up on the mobile version and which content will show up on the desktop version? Okay, but the problem here is about the mobile websites we discussed, such as m.proximus.be, they don't serve the same content. They show totally different content because it's a total different website. Most of the times when a mobile website is specifically set up, so no, not responsive website, but really a separate mobile website, it really actually is separate. There are two different websites managed at two different places. So when you do manage it at one location in one CMS, you actually have responsive websites.